Do you know the number one thing that surprises engaged couples? Take a guess. The sheer amount of decisions they have to make while planning a wedding. Indoors or outdoors? How many guests? Are kids invited? Controversial. Which cake flavor? Seriously, how do you even begin to figure out what's right for you? That's where Zola comes in. Zola has everything you need to make every wedding decision a piece of cake, from choosing your dream wedding venue and vendors to deciding how to best spend your budget. With tons of customizable wedding websites, save the dates and invites, every detail will feel like you. Zola will even help you choose the gifts, experiences, and cash funds you really want. The next thing you know, you've planned your whole wedding all in one place. From getting engaged to getting married, Zola has everything you need to plan your wedding in one place. Start planning at Zola.com. That's Zola.com.
The holidays are all about sharing with family. Meals, couches, stories, grandma's secret pecan pie recipe. And now, you can also share a cart with Instacart's family carts. Everyone can add what they want to one group cart from wherever they are. So you don't have to go from room to room to find out who wants cranberry sauce, or who should get mini marshmallows for the yams, or collecting votes for sugar cookies versus shortbread. Just share a cart and then share the meals and the moments. Download the Instacart app and get delivery in as fast as 30 minutes. Plus, enjoy free delivery on your first three orders. Service fees and terms apply.
Whatever the adventure, there's a BMW engineered to take it on. The X3 delivers a striking design with agile performance. The 100% electric i4 packed with pure electric energy. Or the plug-in hybrid X5, an impressive versatile SUV granting full control on every journey. Choose what powers your next adventure during the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. Hurry in for exceptional offers through January 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
This is the Annie Fry Show.
Welcome to the Annie Fry Show. We are live the day after Christmas here. This is Ryan Wiggins, Ethan Hanford, both here. Brad and Annie have the day off, and they will have some days off, as most of us will, over the next week or so. But we are live today. Let me set up this show for you, though. It's a little bit different style of show than we're used to doing here. I'm not going to call it a best of. We're going to call it the Annie Fry Show Regifted. Because these are the best segments that I could find throughout the entire year. And the way that we're setting this up is that we're going to walk through kind of like the early part of the year here in this first hour, and then the second hour will be the middle of the year through probably about September, and then the third hour, we threw off all the shackles. And not only were we doing the end of the year, but if you know anything about the end of the year, you know, starting January 7th, we were in a pretty good mood. the 2 o'clock hour is a lot of, it's really the best of the funniest things we've done all year, which most of it was in that last quarter of the year. Like, it's been a lot of fun. But we're going to start with one from February. A lot of this is like kind of cool to revisit because you'll see where your mind was at in the month of, you know, whichever one we're in. This one's February. It's a segment where we focus on Gavin Newsom. Here you go. Well, we'll give it a second. Sometimes the computer is a little slow. Sometimes it's Ethan. I don't know which one it is right now.
Old may never know.
We're going to make sure that the light doesn't come on, and we'll just restart this thing whenever we can. But I promise you, and this is a promise I can't keep, but I promise you that regardless of what happens today, this will be the worst moment of it. Because it really is really good material. And since, you know, we're sitting here talking, waiting for the tech to catch up, I'll tell you what's coming up. This is a segment about Gavin Newsom and some ridiculous things that he was saying about a Target employee, which was really, really fun to revisit. Then in this hour, we'll also have Tulsi Gabbard, which was probably the biggest interview that Annie did all year. We're going to replay that. And at the end, of course, a little bit of comedy. We've got some comedy stuff that will pepper throughout until the 2 o'clock hour. So, ready to give this another try?
Let's give it a shot.
All right, here we go.
I'm so excited to have our next guest join the Annie Fry Show here. We're speaking with New York Times bestselling author Tulsi Gabbard, a four-term congresswoman and combat veteran currently serving as lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army Reserve. And we're going to talk about her first book, For Love of Country, which is topping the bestseller charts, available now. And congresswoman, so great to have you. You and I spent some time together. I listened to the audio version of the book, and I was so pleased to get to know so much more about you. Thank you for being with us here today.
Thanks. Thank you so much, Annie. It's great to join you. And thank you for taking the time to read and to listen to the book. I really put a lot of my heart and time into it because of what we're facing as a country right now, and the hopes and really the knowledge that there are a lot of other Americans who have their own path that's very similar to mine. Former Democrats, maybe even current Democrats, people who are politically homeless, and yet who are in a place, unfortunately, where they're too afraid to stand up and speak the truth.
Yeah, I think that going into this book, I was so intrigued at the opportunity to take you in your own words, because I think you're one of the most interesting enigmas that have come out of Washington, D.C. I know that's how we kind of got to know you, is you coming out of Washington, D.C. I'm sure people who go there don't want to be defined by that. But to understand, you know, your book is about leaving the Democratic Party, but that doesn't automatically turn you into Republican. And so people are kind of wondering, like, who are you if you don't fit in this two-party system? What do you stand for? And you lay this out beautifully about the things you care about most. And the thing that I learned the most about you is your long legacy that you've had serving both your country in the military, in political service, and even, you know, in Hawaii, the land that you love there. I think that service is at the key of this. And we do not live in a culture right now that emphasizes serving.
Yeah, Annie, I'm smiling right now because I have been called a quote unquote political enigma for as long as I've been involved with politics.
That's a compliment.
And it is a compliment. It's a reflection of who I am, which is I'm an independent minded person. And my love and my loyalty and my commitment and dedication is to our country and to the American people, not one party or another party. Obviously, there are practical implications of political parties in our system, and I'm very cognizant of that. But for anybody to be simply judged by or forced to fit into a specific box or a specific label, it's just not real. It's not how we are as humans. You know, there are some things I agree with and some things I disagree with. And that's one of the things that I talk about in my book. Was what attracted me originally to the Democratic Party was that it seemed to be a big open tent party that welcomed people who had different ideas and different experiences to actually come and like talk through how do we solve the great challenges of our day, and know that even if we're not starting out on the same page, if we share the same objective, you know, we can get to that best solution through an open dialogue and discussion, through exercising our right to free speech and freedom of expression. And of course, now fast forward 20 plus years, that doesn't exist in today's Democratic Party.
Yeah,
it's one of the most disturbing things because of our fundamental right to free speech and how the Democratic Party has become so undemocratic and so unwelcoming, or completely rejecting people who don't conform to whatever their specific narrative or agenda is of the day. You look at the Republican Party now, and I have a lot of friends in the Republican Party, people I worked with throughout my 8 years in Congress. And, you know, some people, if you watch the mainstream cable news, they're like, oh, gosh, you know, what's wrong with these people? And even some Republicans ask me, like, how are Democrats like so disciplined? They all do whatever their boss says to do. It's not a bad thing. It's a good thing to have a political party that is welcoming of people with very different ideas and views on how to solve these problems. And that's what we should encourage more of in the country, regardless of what party you belong to.
I agree wholeheartedly. Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard with us right now. I want to pull out one little anecdote that really just hit the juxtaposition kind of to what you're saying right there about, you know, a representative goes to Congress, you go to Capitol Hill because you are representing constituents. Now, those constituents for you are in Hawaii. You tell a story here about, and you've been very peace forward, I'll put it that way. You've talked about nuclear war quite a lot as a very serious issue. And there was a time during the Obama administration where there was going to be some action in Syria. And you talked a little bit in your book about a woman you met at a gas station. And then you followed that up with a phone call you got from the chief of staff, from the first lady. And I had to ask myself, like, I had to pause and say, man, once you get there, once you get inside the Beltway, who are you representing? Is it the constituent or the party? And I was going to ask you if you could maybe share a little bit about those two individuals who you spoke to about that. It's really powerful.
Yeah, thanks, Annie. And this directly connects to what we just talked about the difference between blind party loyalty and allegiance, putting party ahead of what's best for the country rather than the other way around, actually putting what's best for the country first and foremost, which is why I titled the book that I did. It is for love of country that I am who I am and that I do what I do. When I was first elected to Congress and sworn in as a new member of Congress, in a very unexpected way to me, there was a lot of noise and positive coverage and soft news stories about me as I was coming as a new member of Congress, a lot of excitement in the Democratic Party. People saying she's the rising star, she's the future, all of these things. They didn't really know who I was. They had read the top lines about me or my bio. But very quickly, within those first few months of my being in office, they recognized I was not going to allow myself to be a puppet for them and their interests. And that the reason why I ran, the priorities that I came and brought with me to Congress was to serve our country and to honor my brothers and sisters who I served with overseas in the Middle East, who never made that trip home, who made that ultimate sacrifice. And so the story you're talking about actually happened about 6 or 7 months after I had been in Congress. President Obama came to Congress seeking authorization to start a new regime change war in the Middle East, this time in Syria. And after I looked at this woman, heard about it in the news, and she stopped me as I was pumping gas in Kapolei on the island of Oahu. And I didn't know who she was, but she grabbed my arm and with tears welling up in her eyes, just shared how she had been so concerned about her son who had been deployed. He had finally come home and she was terrified about the difficulty in transition that he was having of going from being at war for so long and now coming home, only to have this threat popping up in the news that he may be forced to go back yet again. And her fear was that I may lose him forever. I just got him back. They want to take him away again. And for what? And so I've never forgotten that exchange I had with her. I had others similar to that with many people after that. But after going and doing the analysis of what the president was asking of Congress, I came to the conclusion that this is not in the best interest of the American people or our country. There's no clear objective. There's no exit plan. And we would end up likely in yet another decades-long boondoggle like we've seen happen too often in the Middle East. I said that publicly, was the first Democrat to come out against President Obama's request, and immediately got a call from the White House saying, how dare you, not based on substantive differences, the message was, how dare you go against your team? How dare you go against your president without care for, Well, Tulsi, you've been deployed twice in the Middle East. Maybe you have some experience about your concerns. And so this, again, is further evidence of the problem of what happens with politicians who put party before country.
It was very frustrating for me to hear that, but I think it's realistic to think about the party pressure that gets put on people once they go to represent. But it's not just intra-party that pressure hits. I mean, we've seen, you talk in your book also about the Google suppression. You had this great peak of interest after your debate, and that was immediately like, oh, that's problematic. We got to stop that. Google participated in squashing that, and now we know in 2024 how much more big tech has participated in shaping the narrative. And, you know, with everything that you've learned, Tulsi, with the really great force to keep you at bay in the Democrat Party so much that you said, peace out, that I wonder how much of the whole narrative has been shaped for us and how many Americans are kind of waking up going, everything that I've been told for so long, it just doesn't feel right. They got a gut feeling. The Biden administration is not really making the case very strongly for the Democrat Party. Like, where do you think the mental space is right now for the average, not super politically involved American voter?
Yeah, first, just real quick, you know, you mentioned Google, you mentioned big tech. A lot of the evidence that has actually come to light in the years after my own personal experience of Google intervening on behalf of the Democratic National Party. People ask me in my book, I talk a lot about the Democrat elite. They say, who are the Democrat elite? Well, those are two examples. It is not only the elected figureheads of the party that we know of, Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer and Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, but it is their partners in the mainstream media. It is big tech and social media moguls. It is those who are willing to do their bidding. It is their multi-billion dollar funders like George Soros. These are the people pulling the strings. These are the people making decisions. I think because of the consequences of these insane policies, like trying to tell us a boy can be a girl anytime he says, I am a girl, forcing girls into a position where Title IX is totally destroyed and any possibility of a true, fair, and equal level playing field for women and girls in sports is gone out the window under this administration. You look at things like defund the police, their open border policies, and how they're affecting communities and cities all across the country. I think as these things continue to escalate, more and more Americans do have that gut feeling that I don't pay attention to politics, but what's happening is not good. My paycheck is going shorter and shorter. I can't afford to buy the things that I used to be able to afford. These things are becoming harder and harder for people to deny. I'm encouraging them to recognize the cause of people's problems through this book, and therefore then recognize, okay, what do I as an American need to do about this? Because we all have to own our responsibility to save our country, to defend our freedom.
Congressman Tulsi Gabbard with us right now. We're speaking about her latest book, For Love of Country, Leave the Democrat Party Behind. I encourage you to get it. I've read it myself, and I highly recommend it to get a full understanding in Tulsi's own words, who she is and why she's not a Democrat anymore and where she is right now. I mean, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention your presidential aspirations that have existed. And you really did, even in the midst of all of the opposition, get the attention of the American people. I'm curious if you still have those presidential aspirations, if they're near to your heart right now, or how you feel about a potential run once again.
You know, the thought has never entered my mind that I am, you know, I've chosen a quote unquote political career. I've never seen it that way. And so I've never aspired, oh, well, one day I will be president for the sake of being president. I've no interest in that. My run for the presidency in 2020, and if I were to run again, would be rooted in a recognition that that there is not someone else already stepping up to the plate who I feel confident in, is committed to our Constitution, committed to putting the American people first, who is not beholden to the military-industrial complex, and who takes seriously my brothers and sisters in uniform and the choice that we've made to lay down our lives for our country and understand the cost that comes with that decision between war and peace. If that person is there, then I wouldn't need to run for president. Whether I run again or not, I don't know. My goal is to serve our country and to uphold the oath that I took to the Constitution.
If I may, just one final question. We're speaking with Tulsi Gabbard, yes, about her latest book. When people like you feel as though, you know, maybe I didn't leave the Democrat Party, the Democrat Party left me, somewhere in there where positions haven't totally changed, but you just don't recognize the party that you used to support. People are compelled right now to think it's the Democrat Party and Trump. And the idea of leaving the Democrat Party and directly supporting Trump seems like a jolt for a lot of people. You've experienced time with Donald Trump as an individual, as a man, as somebody who has run this country. What advice do you give to those people who feel like this Democrat Party isn't for me anymore, knowing that Donald Trump is the consequence of less support for the Democrat Party?
You know, I just encourage people to set whatever, you know, feelings or emotions that they may have around certain individuals aside and actually focus on the consequences of policies. This is a unique time in our country where we have two people running against each other, both asking to be our president and both who have served as president. They actually have a record that we can look to. We don't just have to buy what they're saying and hope they mean what they say. There's an actual record and comparison to know what kind of president they would be and the results of their policies. And so whether we're talking about border security, the economy, the inflation that we are continuing to experience now for years, we look at foreign policy and domestic policy. We look at the security of our country and our ability to live in safe and peaceful communities. You may not be hope-inspired. You may not have your ideal dream candidate. This is the real world that we live in. And the choice that we have before us, in my view, is very clear. And the differences are stark.
Yeah.
People will make their decisions on Election Day. But I just encourage people to make sure that those are informed decisions and think about what is in the best interest of you and your kids, your family, and our ability to live in a truly free, safe, and peaceful society.
Yeah, but we have such a clear choice in front of us, and this current way of doing things is not sustainable. Tulsi Gabbard, the book is For Love of Country, Leave the Democrat Party Behind. I encourage people to check out the audiobook because you have a wonderful voice to listen to, keep you company for a while. Thank you so much for the time today. It's been an honor to have you.
Great to talk to you, Annie. Thank you so much.
Thank you. You as well.
You're listening to The Annie Fry Show. Find the podcast, on-demand audio, and more at 971talk.com/Annie.
This is the Annie Fry Show.
Remember when you did dedications?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was during
awesome.
COVID, wasn't it?
You were a listener.
I was a listener. Yeah, you could text in and be like, tweet in, and you could have them. Ryan would be like, well, how did you do it? He was like, this is Ryan Wiggins, and this
it
song
was so weird.
It
was like a KZK Pillow Talk dedications. That's how we played bump music. It came with, ooh, it's February. Maybe we should do that for Valentine's Day. Like maybe the week up. When is Valentine's Day? I know it's 14th.
On a Wednesday.
It's a Wednesday?
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Yeah. Ooh, you're listening to the Annie Fry Show.
No, I don't like it when you say it like that.
This one goes out to Lori. She's been a little bit lonely lately with her husband on the road so much, but we're going to play for you a great one from Rod Stewart. Here we go.
Which one would that be?
I don't even remember.
I don't think there is one.
You're right. I'm not a big Rod Stewart fan.
I don't like Rod Stewart. I don't disrespect his career. Doesn't he have a song called Maggie May?
Yes.
I love the name Margaret, and my sister-in-law's name is Margaret, but I love the name Margaret. And that song made me be like, I don't want her to be called Maggie because I just don't like Rod Stewart.
Wow.
Man.
That's pretty.
I don't like his thing. I don't mind him. I don't care.
What? I don't like his music.
Get
nor
the show
his
back
thing.
On the road.
No, I can't. I can't now. You stepped in. I had a plan. I mean, we were going to roll.
All right.
But
roll
don't worry
it.
About it. Okay, well, I don't have access to the sound, but I was going to play the Joe Biden clip again, if you want to go ahead.
Just the one that we've been playing over again? Why, you've got more to talk about?
I think I figured out what he was doing.
You should have told me that before we went on the air.
Jobs. Remember they told us we were dead, manufacturers dead in America, China was going to eat our lunch? Well, guess what, man? We don't taste that good.
Boom!
So look, folks, I really mean it.
I'm glad he added that. I thought he was joking.
I didn't mean that.
People would be like, oh, shoot, I don't know where to go with this. So FYI, I did a little research, and I haven't looked it up on the whitehouse.gov yet, but I have determined pretty conclusively that I think he was just trying to quote scripture there.
I just spit.
Yeah, it was. He probably walked in with this on his note card, and what came out was what you heard. But on the note card, it would have read, quote, Revelation 10:9. So I went to the angel and told him to give me the small scroll. Yes, take it and eat it, he said. It will be sweet as honey in your mouth, but it will turn sour in your stomach. That was what he was intending to do.
All right, Brad, you get the next segment. That was a mistake.
The next segment's Wiggins America.
I want to piggyback onto what we wrapped the show last segment up with. When you listen to the CNN commentator, they're talking about how what they have a system. You steal in these immigrants come together. They steal in New York, then they go to Florida. That is a distance. That's not like saying
it's not easy to do.
It's not like you're saying, oh, you go. Thieve in Illinois, and then you cross the Mississippi into St. Louis and you know, whatever. They steal in New York, they go to Florida to spend the money, and then they go all the way back to New York to steal again. And the reason why they don't just stay in Florida is they say, because when you're in Florida, you get arrested. You go to jail. Did you hear Gavin Newsom, his Zoom meeting? This is amazing. Do you know who the Zoom meeting was with?
No, I looked that up, and it you can't tell, but it was like friendly faces. It was a bunch of people looked like a government Zoom meeting.
Didn't you feel like this wasn't something we were supposed to see?
It does look like, when you watch the whole thing, that this was before the meeting started, and he was just kind of riffing and talking to everybody.
Well, whoever filmed it on a cell phone.
Yes.
You are never safe, just so you know that. Not even you, Gavin Newsom.
Checking out, the woman says, oh, he's just walking out. He didn't pay for that. I said, well, why are you stopping him? She goes, oh, the governor. I swear to God, true story. On my mom's grave. The governor lowered the threshold. There's no accountability. I said, that's just not true. And she said, we have the 10th toughest, $950, the 10th toughest in America. She doesn't even know what I was talking about. By the way, it's the 10th toughest in America. Look it up.
Interject here before we get to the rest of it. He's like, this cashier was so dumb. This cashier is out there. If she's not on Jesse Waters tonight, then Jesse Waters has failed me. But the idea that he's standing there and he's talking about going to Target. He's talking about being a Target, just like you might be well, you probably are going to Target. Let's imagine you're at Walmart.
Yeah.
I still want to do a YouTube video where we do something like what to do if you see another conservative in Target. There are like only a few responsible reactions.
You put your hood up and your mask on.
Yeah. Like, oh, no.
Nobody can see me, right?
He's in Target. He's checking out and he literally witnesses theft right in front of him.
Yeah.
And he says, the governor of California says to this really dumb cashier, why aren't you going to go get him? And she says, we're not allowed to because of the governor.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
And like, I don't think that there is a single cashier out there who would say that if they didn't know he was the governor.
If they didn't know that Newsom was the governor. Not that they were talking to him.
I think this is the smartest cashier in America.
See, I don't get the sense that she knew she was talking to him.
I think that this is 4D chess.
Oh.
Because he is so offended. I'm going to continue to play here. He is so bothered. Not by the fact that this person was stealing something right in front of him. Not by the fact that she said something about how California laws aren't good enough. He is the most bothered that he doesn't feel recognized enough.
Yes.
What a narcissistic... I'll keep playing.
No one gives a damn about that. And I said, it's just not true. There's still... Stop. They said, well, we don't stop them because of the governor. And then she goes, she looks at me twice, and then she freaks out. She calls everyone over, wants to take photos. I'm like, no, I'm not taking a photo. We're having a conversation. Where's your manager? How are you blaming the governor?
Where's your
manager?
And it was,
you know, $380 later. And I was like, why am I spending $380? Everyone can walk the hell right out.
Wait!
What?
No!
What?
What?
Why am I spending money when I could just be stealing it?
Because
the governor wouldn't stop it. Oh, wait, somebody call the governor.
And I would have been like, see, the governor didn't stop that one either. Because you're standing right here. You go stop him. It's unbelievable. It's right in front of their face. And he really sounds. I'm of the mind that these people, and when I say these people, I'm capitalizing the T and the P in these people. And Gavin Newsom is of the elite of these people, that they know exactly what they're doing. But this gives me pause. This makes me feel he's way dumber than the cashier is. He's way dumber than the little people of California who don't even know who their governor is. He sounds ridiculous in this. You want a picture? I'm not giving you a picture. Where's your manager?
Yeah.
What are you going to say to the manager, Karen? Sorry, Karens. I want to play this from Gutfeld last night because it was perfect.
I think he's amazing. I think we found three words to best describe him. Where's the manager? America needed a name for a male Karen, and it's Gavin. Gavin is such a great name for a male.
He's right.
Karen. I feel bad for all the Gavins out there watching. There's probably like 300 or 400. But he did it. I didn't. Because he combines in that moment the sense of entitlement and the desire to complain. Right? That's the definition of what this person is. I'm surprised he didn't pull out his phone and start filming the poor clerk who's essentially given up. It's not her fault. It's not her fault. She's just given up because she's not allowed to do anything because then the insurance companies will come down. But in that moment, you saw an example of how liberal leaders are wholly divorced from the consequences of their politics.
Gavin, we should liberate the Karens.
Yeah, yeah, make them Gavins.
They've done enough. And in fact, many of them didn't do anything to deserve it.
Most of them didn't.
It's Gavin's time. This is your moment.
What shocks me about that whole thing, I mean, we could do probably 3 hours on that clip because there's so much to it. But one of the things that I haven't seen anybody online talking about, when this is hitting, is that he watches somebody steal what he says is like $380 mm-hmm. worth of goods, because that's about what he's buying, which is incredible because I don't ever have enough $400 to go to Target. But beside the point,
well, I mean, you're going to Target in California. So.
That's true. Yeah, he watches. You have to pay for all the theft.
Two jugs of milk and some eggs.
Yeah. So he watches somebody walk out stealing, and somebody actually helps him. He says at the beginning that the guy drops something, and somebody walks up and gives him back the thing he dropped so that he can walk out stealing it. Then the person says, oh, yeah, it's the governor. You know, we can't do anything because of the governor. Instead of talking about how, man, that bothers me, he starts citing stats to her. You're literally watching somebody walk out of the store with stuff.
It's the same thing he did to Ron DeSantis in that debate.
Yes.
And it's like everyone's just kind of putting their hands out dramatically to the side. Here it is. And he's like, we are the 10th best state. And I'm like, why not shoot for the 9th or the 3rd or the 2nd? Or maybe just go get that guy who's stealing things right now. And you're like, let me talk to the manager. The manager is busy.
Yeah. I don't think you understand. I know that you just saw theft right there. And I saw it too. But since I'm the governor, I'm going to tell you, let me tell you about some stats you might not be aware of. It is the ultimate reality shift. It's so academic versus what's actually happening with the results of those policies played out right there in front of him, and he still can't see it.
He's mad, like he sees it, but he's mad that he's being blamed for it. He's like, what? Like, this is no, not my fault.
And they start taking selfies, and he goes, no, I don't want pictures. I'm trying to have a conversation with you. I need to educate you. Stop all this and listen to me right now.
I think America's getting it. I think they're getting it.
Yeah.
Just in the nick of time. Put your hands together and say a prayer. It is amazing. In New York, on CNN, they're like, yeah, people steal in New York, spend in Florida, and don't want to get arrested in Florida, so they go back to New York. I mean, if you're Ron DeSantis, you're doing the hand thing, like, ta-da! And if you're the cashier and Gavin Newsom's up there telling you about these statistics, you're pointing at the door where the guy just left. Ta-da! And they're sitting there and they're still yapping, going, yeah, but, here's how we know better than you. Here's why you're stupider than me. Listen to the oozy, drippy disdain that Gavin Newsom mm-hmm. has for his plebes that are checking him out at Target and not checking him out, which is why he was so sad. She didn't even know who I was. But it's amazing. If she doesn't know who she is, but she still knows your policies, that's a smart voter.
Yeah, he said to her afterwards, he goes, you don't even know who you're talking to. And they took off his glasses, opened up his shirt. He goes, I am the governor. She goes, oh my gosh, let me take a selfie. No, I need to educate you before you do that.
It's amazing. Man, keep going, America. Keep going. Lay it on thick.
This is Ryan Wiggins. Let me tell you a little bit about how we put together the best of the year. I went into the best of episodes that we had done at other holidays, and I found kind of, so you've maybe heard a couple of these already because, you know, you would have had the best of President's Day, the best of Labor Day, the best of 4th of July, stuff like that. And each one of those is spaced about equidistant to where you'd have a couple months behind it. And so this hour, we're walking through the first kind of half of the year. The second hour coming up, the 1 o'clock hour, we're going to walk through most of the second half of the year. But then, without trying to really make it this way, we wanted to do the 2 o'clock hour as the really the best of the funniest stuff. And there's some other funny stuff. Like, I'm going to play something here that's fairly funny here just in a second. But that 2 o'clock hour, I think we've just been lit since November. We're in a good mood. We're just doing a lot of just really zany stuff and bouncing off the walls. I think after November 7th, we were on a pretty good mood. So there's maybe like one thing that was before November 7th, but most of it is afterwards. And one of them is, Annie, are you okay with Trisha? Is like the funniest segment we do all week. And when she's not here, we're all sad. So Ethan picked that one for the 2 o'clock hour.
Funniest on-air segment I've ever been a part of. I have never laughed harder when I tell you that I fell to the floor at least twice in the segment. I'm not kidding.
And that was not that long ago. Beginning of December. So here's one from, I think this is from maybe March or April. It is our discussion, starts with Annie talking about her daughter, but it is our discussion about emojis.
Molly told me last night she was being real sassy when we got home, and she was just in a sassy two-year-old mood, like having fun. And I told her something, I said something playful. She goes, "Shut up." And I go, "Hey." Like, wow. She could tell immediately that the tone in this room has changed. But I wanted her to know immediately. I mean, I'm not offended if she tells me to shut up. She's never going to do it again without knowing it's wrong. But I don't want her to go tell other people. Like, she needs to learn that lesson at home. And I told her, I was like, "You do not say that to mommy. Say sorry right now." And she just puts her hands down. Like, she's standing there in the hall. And she puts her hands, her arms sulking, just straight down the side. And she puts her head down. She goes, "I can't." And I'm like, "Say you're sorry." And she's like, "I can't." We did it for like 5 minutes. And I'm looking at Jared, and Jared is behind her laughing at me. I'm like, "Tell her to say you're sorry. She told me to shut up." And he's like, "You say you're sorry or you're going into timeout," which, as if you've heard the show before, is the rug by the front door, because then timeout goes everywhere because everybody has a front door rug. And he says that, and she's like, "Sorry." And I was like, "I'll allow it. I forgive you, child. Don't tell me to shut up again." Anywho.
How old is she?
2.5.
2.5.
And every single bit of
that's
it.
Perfect. That's
arms
perfect.
Arms down. Can't.
I love it.
Standing right in front, like 30 seconds before, she was as happy as a 2.5-year-old could be. And now she can't tell me she's sorry after she goes, "Shut up."
It's amazing how much the emotions of kids at that age mirror
all over the place.
But they mirror what you have inside of you.
You haven't
learned
to control it.
You just don't do that anymore.
Although I've had to tell people I'm sorry before, and I wanted to go, "I can't." And then the head's hanging down, and then they just look up at the top of you to see if you're, mom's still looking crap.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll tell that to you next time I feel offended. Annie, mm-hmm. Tell me you're sorry.
I can't.
She'll look you dead in the eye.
Yeah.
Well, that's true. She's not going to look away. I'll become uncomfortable looking over at Annie. Oh, my gosh, she's still looking at me.
You apologize to me.
No, I'm sorry. I will.
And I forgive you. Doesn't that feel good?
How about this? Emojis in work emails. Learn to write a professional email.
A-fa-rickin-men. Yes.
The number of Gen Z kids I've had who send me emails without salutations, with emojis and shorthand like LOL, OMG, etc., without proper spelling and punctuation is crazy.
The implication is that I care how you feel.
I actually do not mind emojis in everything.
I bet
it gives
you
me
don't.
An idea of how you feel about what
you
you're
worry
saying.
About what everybody feels.
All the time.
Yeah.
I'm a feeler. And I want to know how you feel. I want you to, if you tell me, "Hey, you know what? I need you to get done by the end of the day."
Every
which
single
is with
thing.
A little thumbs up at the end. I'm like, "Hey, all right, I can do it."
Yeah, but I think Leah, doesn't Gen Z not like the thumbs up?
I hate it.
See? And Ryan, I'm going to send emojis to you every text now, but it's only the angry face.
No, don't do that.
Bleeped out mouth.
No. It'll be like, "Wiggins America looks okay today. Angry face." I'd be like, oh, crap.
Apologize. Say you're sorry.
I'm so sorry.
I can't.
I'm fine with more emojis. Boomers in emails. I'm going to send you more emojis than
Brad,
ever.
Brad, you need emojis?
No.
You're
but
not
I don't,
mad at him.
I'm not mad at him. I think whenever you're trying to display sarcasm or that you're joking, I think they're helpful.
Leah, do you send them? You send them. You're an emoji user.
Well, I send them in text. I would never send it in an email.
Okay, so you understand
like
the difference.
Email's more professional. You want to look professional.
Yeah. Ryan.
What anyway. About salutations? Do you have to start an email with
that's
hey,
how that's
Annie.
How Ryan says hello
I do.
Every day.
Email that I send for a guest request or
address.
Anything, I always.
But what if it's to one of us? Do you have to say, "Hey, Ryan," and then the body of the,
I would
of
just
the email
say, hey.
Still?
But I don't email you guys. I text you guys.
Yeah.
Well,
I also think it matters what you're doing. If I'm asking you to do something that I know that you're not going to be like super excited to, I'm going to write that email nicer. Except
make
for
sure you put tons angry of good emojis in it, like sunglasses face and like crying, laughing at nothing. Just because.
Say you're sorry.
No, I will not.
I can't.
I'm a tough, tough guy. This is the Annie Fry Show. We're
you're
doing
a
the
tough,
best.
Tough guy.
Thank you, thank you. We are live. Welcome to the day after Christmas. We are walking through some of the best little bits of the year. These are early in the year, so that was probably, like I said, somewhere around April. We have one short clip I'm going to try to fit in here that's it's a conversation about being called chief by a waiter at a restaurant.
Wiggins America.
Husband was at, I remember, a Pizza Hut in Little Rock going to visit my husband's uncle. And the Pizza Hut waiter, this was when my husband and I had first started dating. So he was like, maybe 22 or something, I don't know. And this waiter was just treating everybody normal, but kept calling my husband chief.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a different conversation.
I know, but the whole time it was going on, he would call him chief. And my husband, like, if you know Jared, which you guys know Jared, he's not really like a hey, chief kind of guy.
Mm-hmm. Would you say I am? Because I am not, but I think you would say that I am.
I would pay a waiter to call you chief on the side just to watch that.
Yeah.
But, I mean, through the entire meal, ma'am, would you like some more Diet Pepsi? Yeah, I think. What about you, chief? Like, the whole time.
And he was younger?
He's 22.
So he was a little
really
young,
good looking. That's when we were dating. He's still good looking. I just said that wrong.
Wait. The waiter?
The waiter was saying that about my husband.
I know.
My husband.
I was asking about the waiter, and then you said really good looking.
Is good looking.
Okay. What did the waiter look like?
I have no idea.
On a scale of 1 to 10.
I have no idea.
Okay. That doesn't really factor in the story. I was just wondering.
You want to know if he was hot?
Well, I wanted to know if he was young. Yeah, I did. I want to know if he was younger than your husband.
No, probably the same age.
Does that play into it? Okay.
No, it's probably the same age. There are questions, definitely, about what was going on there.
Mm-hmm.
And Jared was just like, he didn't know what to do.
You think was he demeaning your then boyfriend trying to make you like him?
I don't think that I factored into the whole situation very much.
So he wasn't, but wait, was he playing kind of I'm bigger than you?
I don't think my husband was the threat in this three person situation. I think maybe I was.
Wait,
chief.
You were the threat. That's what I'm saying. You were the threat. So he was trying to impress you.
Can you mansplain this to Ryan?
I don't know if I can because I don't know how you are a threat in that situation.
I don't either. That's what I'm asking.
Because he was calling your husband a name,
mm-hmm.
and it wasn't sir. Mm-hmm. He's calling him chief.
Mm-hmm.
But
were you waving your fists at him?
Mm-mm.
No, okay.
But he just called you ma'am?
I don't know what he called me. He was not interested in me.
Oh. Well.
Okay.
This is the slowest radio show on the history of the planet. We'll be back at some point. You guys, seriously.
Okay. Oh my God. See, that was before you, Ethan. That was before you were on the show.
That was pre-Ethan.
So you had not heard that.
No.
Did you catch that she was saying that he was hitting on? See, I didn't either.
I didn't either.
Okay, good. That it's either
she
a guy
calls
thing.
It slow. I think that she has unfair expectations of us male brains.
I do too. Yeah, she's clearly on a different level, and she needs to slow down.
I agree. I agree.
This is the Annie Fry Show. This is the best of the year of the Annie Fry Show. We're calling it the Annie Fry Show Regifted. The next hour is going to be awesome. We get into a lot of the funnier stuff, but really a really good interview from Tammy Bruce in the middle of the hour, too. Now, this comes from August. And it's really interesting because at the moment in August that Tammy Bruce is being interviewed there in the next hour, we knew that Kamala Harris had now become the nominee. But we had just learned that Tim Walz had become the vice presidential nominee. And she has some serious thoughts. And what's interesting is she goes on about here's the direction America will go if Kamala Harris wins. And she talks for probably 5 minutes straight about here's where it goes. It is all stuff that obviously we've avoided now, but it's so easy to quickly forget how close we were to some of these things. Now, we don't know what the next 4 years is exactly going to be like, but we know it's not going to be this. So stick around. More of the best of the Annie Fry Show. Annie Fry Show regifted with some really funny stuff to start the hour, then Tammy Bruce, and then some sitcom things. Maybe you remember that when we did that in October. That'll be at the end of the hour. That's coming up.